This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome, everyone, to the show. Frank Rossi here with Dr. Ben McGraw from Penn State University, who we're going to get to a little bit and talk about insects from the spring. We've been trying to do this for a while, and it's been a funky spring. So let me start out like I usually do with putting our kids to work on the golf course. A lot of great tweets, as usual. This became something that got popular during the pandemic, and so pleased to see golf course superintendents exposing their kids like this to the work and being outside and the toils of what we love about being on golf courses. Many of us know not long ago we lost Dr. Joe Vargas, a friend of mine, and I'm sure an acquaintance of Ben's over the years from Michigan State. I have been quiet about this. Joe was a really important part of my early career when I first started at Michigan State. And the guy next to him was no slouch himself, Gordy LaFontaine. We lost Joe just a month ago, and they had the service for him this past weekend. And in this picture, you can see Gordy LaFontaine holding the mic for Dr. Paul Ricci, who just celebrated his 90th birthday. So while we grieve the passing of a turf grass giant, we continue to celebrate having Dr. Ricci around. So having roots in as a Sparty for my couple of years there early on still touches my heart. Joe always had a smile and a kind word. And for those of people who, you know, always might have had a difficult time with Joe, I was never one of those people. I got along with him perfectly well. I think it was, Ben, we're all crusty Northeasterners. Joe was a classic New Englander from the get-go. Okay, so this past week, we were pretty warm to the east. As you got near the ocean and even north, you were pretty warm. As soon as you got towards central Pennsylvania and west, you got a little bit cooler. Some places in the high elevations, 8 degrees below normal, where you were really up high. So cooler towards the southwest and warmer towards the northeast. Now, what's been really interesting is we're starting to see heat stress levels already build. And these are models that we developed when the nighttime temperature is at least 70 degrees. And the combination of the temperature and the humidity is over 150 for more than 5 or 6 hours. We call that heat stress. So what you can see here is the heat stress is going to be with us downstate and even in southwest Pennsylvania, Ben, where you are, and then slowly dissipate as the week goes on. We are not expecting to see much of this stress. Now, what's also interesting typically follows this when you get moisture are foliar diseases. And normally we talk about dollar spot, but whenever the heat starts to build, you can start to see it building towards the southwest today and tomorrow, but really only persists in the Boston area, the Metro New York area, the I-95 corridor down to Washington, D.C. In places where brown patch is likely to be a problem, I would want to make sure I had some protection in place along the shore and the I-95 corridor south of New York City. It's looking like it's going to be a pretty good run for brown patch for the week. Soils are warm, and in fact, they've been getting warm, and as they in places where they're drier, they're even warmer, well into the 70s in Metro New York, and pretty much 60s everywhere else. So biological activity is well underway in all the soils in the Northeast. So again, as the rainfall comes with warm soils, you could expect a surge of growth on the other side of that if your soil is functioning, right? If your soil is really able to process the organic matter, mineralize that nitrogen, you should get a growth response on the other side of some expected rainfall that's passing through the Northeast this weekend. It's been pretty dry. It's been wet in Beantown. I know the Red Sox are not loving it as wet as it's been. And also a little bit down by you, Ben, in southwest Pennsylvania. Look like you got a little bit of rainfall down there. But really, for the most part, the majority of the region has been dry this past week. And it looks like a little bit of a break. I never really liked these prognostications. It looks like it might be warmer than normal. It looks like it might be a little bit wetter than normal, but What we've been talking about in our sort of extension conference call world has been the patterns of rainfall are coming through, but we may not be getting that much rain. Now, we might get a bit of a dump through a storm coming through in the next day or two, but it looks like rainy, showery conditions, but not major rainfall expected. Now, Ben, I had a laugh. When I used to watch my kids play soccer, I didn't bother sitting with anyone. I just stood off by myself. I wasn't a big yeller, but I didn't also want to be near anybody because, on the off chance something happened, I'm likely to just punch them as a reaction. So I know this was a very interesting time, and you tweeted about it. So I won't talk more about it. I'm going to leave
It's fine.
it. Get into marital issues. I got my own trouble. Okay, so let's get into our conversation today, Ben, and let's start with something that's very pertinent to New York, although maybe not necessarily this year. We are expecting a ban of neonicotinoid insecticides across the state of New York. This is probably likely going to happen in other places as well. I doubt we're going to be an isolated state for this particular rule. So I want to talk a little bit about alternatives and worries, right? Because on Long Island, we don't have a Cellebrin, right? We have a limitation for some of our use down there. Let's start out with how worried are you about this, and how much confidence do you have in alternatives like I put up here, entomophagous nematodes and maybe BT galerii?
Oh, we're gonna get into some difficult talk here,
Yeah,
right from
okay.
the start.
Right
So,
from the start.
I gotta say, I gave a talk at the New England Turf Regional Conference, and somebody came up to me and was like, "Hey, I'm from, because they draw from Long Island at that conference," and they're like, "We don't have a Cellebrin," and I was shocked by that. I mean, that's one of the softest chemistries that we've seen. It impacts or it affects the insect by binding to a receptor that humans don't have, so it's virtually non-toxic to mammals. It's safe to the applicator. Just one of those crazy things that you don't have in New York. So I was unaware of that, and what we're seeing with the neonic issue is like it's changing by the month here in all of the states around us. Maryland, New Jersey, Connecticut, possibly having a ban. So it's hard to keep up on all these things. My home state of Maine has moved to a ban. I've written lots of letters and all of this stuff, and I do think we have better alternatives. So I haven't been. I mean, I'm happy to support the turf industry in writing letters and whatnot, and I think there's some pretty clear science that in the turf grass world, it's not a huge issue because we're watering these products in. Any white grub product, you need to deliver it down to the target. So that removes a lot of the risk. If you don't have the ability to get water to these sites, maybe it's an estate or a park or a golf course rough, where we typically would see these grubs. And there's a lot of people who don't have irrigation to rough. So just by selecting a granular formulation immediately removes the risk. That's work that Dan Potter did 100 years ago,
So there's
whatever.
ways to work with neonics that you can minimize the risk. So what was the hubbub? I heard it was about seed treatments in ag. Doesn't that minimize risk as well by just putting it on the seed?
Oh, I think that, I mean, I would love to, where I'm getting with this is I'd love to see turf treated differently as far as banning, but nobody's, it's hysteria and nobody's really willing to look at the science. And I do think that seed treatment is bad. The neonic and, maybe companies could have avoided this. We know that turf and ornamentals are small potatoes, so we're just going to get caught in the crossfire. What happens with a seed treatment with the neonics, and this science is very clear that it does impact pollinator populations. This is excellent work out of Purdue, Christian Krupke's lab. And you want to talk about somebody who did great research that, kind of got caught in the crosshairs from these chemical companies. When you place the neonicotinoid on the seed treatment, there's a lot of evidence that it might not work in northern agriculture, but in southern agriculture, that product's there and it gets the insects that it needs to get. Northern, it might not. But the big problem is when you put them in the cedars, it basically volatilizes the compound. So any plume of neonicotinoid coming through pollinating insect populations is just going to smoke them
So
out of the
you're talking
sky.
about dust
Yeah,
from
essentially
putting the seed
dust.
together.
Yeah. So not volatilization, but the dust coming off of this. So that's very clear. So I don't think that we need to treat these things as, good or bad. There's lots of nuances with that. In the turf world, what we can speak about is you do want to water every white grub product, you want to water it. And these are products that water in, and once you water it in, they're pretty benign. Unfortunately, it's kind of blanket treatment, and there's enough momentum. This thing's running downhill that it's probably going to be lost. Now, where we do have great alternatives, like the diamides, and there are differences within the diamides, so I don't want to paint with a broad brush,
Well, and
but
also just clarification, golf has access to acelaprin.
correct.
It's lawn care and landscape that are not going to have the access to acelaprin.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate, I think. And if we look at within the diamides, there is great variation. I wouldn't say that a Fahrenz would be similar, or even a Tetrino, which New York doesn't have yet. Those are not the same as acelaprin as far as pollinator safety. So acelaprin, gold standard for white grub control, really, really soft on pollinating
Okay,
populations.
so then let's talk about these other options. I know you played around with nematodes as a grad student,
Oh
right?
yeah, I think we more
And
than played with them.
Galerii has gotten some momentum. Thoughts on effectiveness? Because we know behavior is going to have to change a little bit. I'm wondering about effectiveness of these products.
So we're gonna delve into some tricky area here because I've had a CEO of a company crawl upside my about this stuff. So what I'm gonna say is that both can be effective. However, one is a, they're biological, so we assume that they are more benign than or less
Well,
harmful
we're
than
talking about a living
neurotoxin.
organism, a living
Correct.
organism with the nematode, and you're
Right.
talking about a BT formulation with the grub gum.
Yeah, so with the nematodes, we want to overwhelm them with high numbers of very healthy individuals, infective juveniles. And when we can do that, we can overwhelm the pest population. So we know that they can be. There's all, we've known this for, decades and decades and decades. The problem is supply and demand and really getting viable source. So I'll probably get some ire from some biological supply
So
companies, but
you have concerns about the quality control
a
of
hundred percent,
the nematode. Okay, and
a
that's
hundred
valid.
percent.
That's valid, right? That's a valid
So
concern.
we do studies with nematodes all the time, and we get them from online sources or insectaries. And I can tell you, because I did do this for my PhD, that we get batches upon batches that are entirely dead. That is not an uncommon thing. So if I was doing this, and I think they're exceptional. I mean, that was my PhD work. I don't know anybody who's using nematodes to control annual bluegrass weevil. However, we showed in our work you could get 90% control of larvae with a single application. They're comparable in price to our insecticides that we have today. But nobody's doing this. And I think it's a lot of like, what is this? Maybe in Canada, in certain crops, it's very well adopted, mushroom production, Southeast PA, there's nematodes being used. So, it's this kind of market thing. They are living organisms, they don't store well. You need to recycle them through a live hose. That can be rather expensive. So they can be effective. I would want to make sure that I have a viable source. I would want to make sure that they're alive on delivery. So
And you've
that.
got to wait, right? This is a big shift, right, Ben? Because the nematodes are going to go on as you scout in August, not as a preventative in June, are they?
Correct. Correct. So you'd be using them primarily in a curative sense. I know there was work done at Cornell about these long-term persistent nematodes, and
We're not sure yet. Elson Seal's been playing around. What about BT Galerii? Any thoughts?
We've tested this a lot in field trials because anytime a company has a natural product that they want to test, this is usually a standard in it. So we have reams of data. My colleagues have reams of data. I put up a slide a couple of years ago in Ontario with, and the title of the slide was Consistently Inconsistent, and I immediately received some emails from the company. So you can take my I'm not beholden to the company or anything. I'm beholden to the people
Well,
of New York, and
yeah,
that's the
you
only
know what,
thing.
Ben? What I've learned is if I've got people angry at me, it must be because I'm saying something that's true as well. And you know I've gotten
Believe me,
myself.
if it worked, I'd be the number one promoter. We have had trials where it's given good control. We've had trials where absolutely no control. So, again, it's a formulation. This is going to be a little bit more stable, but it's you're going to have variation between batches as well. So.
And also, this is more typical that you'd put on in the spring as a preventative.
No,
Yes?
this would be something that you'd want to put in July so that it's in place for when the it, so it's I wouldn't really describe it as a preventive, but you'd probably want to time it so that when the neonate bites into it that they acquire the most amount of toxin.
All right. All right, we got a lot of ground to cover. ABW is next, right? And there's a lot of funky stuff going on here.
Oh, wicked.
So let's start with this question because, you know, as not an entomologist, the general extension person in the state, I get a lot of questions. And we've really sort of said, okay, there's the Green Day models. And Ben, we've talked about this on the show in the past. We really rely on phenological indicators, and the rhododendron tends to be a strong one. So here's my question: is there a disconnect this year between degree days, phenological indicators, and annual bluegrass weevil populations?
I don't think so.
You don't.
I don't feel that in my travels here. I think these things, I mean, look, we take a lot of samples. We use very precise methods of analyzing what stage the insects are in as far as the larval stages. You know, I'd like to think that a golf course superintendent could do this, but it would be super time consuming to get the level of accuracy that we have. And so with that, I will say that these things generally seem to work pretty well. I've started seeing people say, oh, like, man, as variable as it is every year, it always lands on like Memorial Day. And I would tend to agree. We see a lot of variability at the beginning of the season, and then everything comes together almost in a calendar basis. But our growing degree days have been pretty good. So,
Okay,
and
so here's a
phenological
pic.
indicator.
Yeah, here's a picture from Matthew Legg talking about just that sort of I agree with you. Let me go back for a second. I hear this all the time from Andy Wilson at Bethpage, who's a big scouter, lots of data. He's pretty consistent. You're right. You're going to see it at this time. So I figured maybe with the mild winter and a funky spring, it got a little weird. I'm glad to hear it didn't, because that means maybe control programs are going to work. Matthew Legg with Syngenta Canada just published, put this on Twitter yesterday. And you've got these variety of growth stages here. Do we call this asynchrony, or do you call asynchrony when you have multiple populations, Ben?
Well, I would say asynchrony arises from probably a lack of control of adults. I mean, that's really what's going to lead to asynchrony is if you have something that's laying eggs. So if I look at that, if I take a core and I see, you know, present, let's just say those are first, second, third, and
Fourth.
fourth instars, you know, whether they are or not. Just for example's sake, we got four instars there. That says to me something laid an egg. 7 days ago, 14, 21, 28 days ago. So you've got something that's at, you've got a population of adults that are out there laying eggs for over a month. And we know that if we don't control the adult has a very long time that it can produce eggs. At least we know that from confined field studies. Whether they live that long in the field, probably not. But if we have them confined, they can lay eggs for a long period of time. So what we also see is even in areas where we do have an adulticide down, you're not going to get the entire population. So there's going to be some asynchrony. But I would say if you took enough larval samples or enough turf samples, heat extracted, and look at them underneath the microscope, you would have an average that is moving pretty consistently, whether you applied an adulticide or not.
Okay, so that raises a great question. And we don't have all these products in New York, but these products seem to be the rage when it comes to larvicides, if I'm correct. And I've started to hear, and I know you have cautioned against this in the past, avoid, you know, we have a lot of pyrethroid resistant adult populations, as you know. Like places like Bethpage have really sort of gone away from completely trying to make adulticide applications. We know those things can cause issues when we're trying to control larvae, right? Pyrethroid resistant grow ABWs can be differentially susceptible to larvicides, as I think you've taught me in the past. How do you like these products? Because the other comment you made that still resonates the last time we were on is you basically said, Frank, we got enough products now. We know enough about this now. I don't think this is a major pest problem anymore that can't be managed. Maybe the problems that we used to have are not the problems controlling we have nowadays. I'm a little bit nervous because relying on larvicides, as you said, could be risky. So tell me how to put this into context without an adulticide and relying on a larvicide. Am I just making three larvicide applications now instead of three adulticide applications? Clear this up for me, Ben.
Well, I do think that sequential applications are needed, whether that's an adulticide followed by a larvicide. And that's it's basically, I have a couple of consulting courses that I do on the side, and we've taken these places that have probably made four springtime applications, we're two and done. And then we're even kind of looking whether we need to make a summer application. Many of these are super high end, and that's really kind of an insurance app.
100%.
However, I really like the adulticide followed by a larvicide, but I know that some people don't want to go that route. I would still caution against relying on a single product. We just wrapped our 2 weeks of field trial data, so this is all really early. It seems like a lot of the submissions that these companies have made are these programs, and I am a big believer in programs, but from a recommendation standpoint, it's very difficult for me to say this solo product does this unless we're looking at that solo product. The other complicating thing is the insect's going to move, it's going to lay eggs over time. So if we're looking at the contribution of a single larvicide, that could be difficult to assess because it's got to work on much longer that spread out asynchronous development. So I do think we have a lot of products. I mean, obviously from our trials were great this year. So I think it's going to be a banner year. We're coming off a couple of crap years where it's like, am I going to work the rest of my life on ants and earthworms and these unsolvable things? Or can we get back to like the early 2000s ABW level? And what we've seen is some places that have been really bit hard. But I do think, like a lot of the places that I consult with, or a lot of the places where we have trials where we're doing what we recommend, those things are non-problems. They really are. I mean, I think it's really about timing, as we all know. And I think it's about using products that make sense relative to the life cycle of the insect. I'm seeing a lot of freestyling, though. I am just seeing, like, I don't know if people have like chemical sheds where you've got eight things that you think are recognizable that you heard in a talk somewhere, but people are absolutely friggin' freestyling out there. I'm not on Facebook, but if somebody shared a Facebook post where it was like, what's the best product for ABW larval control? And I saw about 20 responses from these people where, and it was like a, the sequential program with like two products that are not effective. It's like, so I do think we don't need to. I mean, this insect doesn't occur uniformly across a property. And when that happens, people are going to think that they get good control with marginal products. And I
Okay, so
think
let
this
me,
year is going to really flesh that out.
Okay, so good. So I want to recap what you just said. Your studies, your trials are indicating we got a lot of annual bluegrass weevils out there this year after a
Absolutely.
couple of years of not very much. No surprise on the Facebook baloney, but the social media thing, if you know, there's a lot of things we don't get right there. So you want to be very careful when you're making choices. And it sounds like once you get enough data and you are able to start making timely applications, this no longer is going to be a primary issue. That said, it's expanding its range, Ben. Is it behaving differently the further south you get, the further into Ohio you get? Are there any nuances that are different for this organism as it's expanded its range from the Northeast where it's been for 40 years. I've been spraying this thing for 40 years since I was working on golf courses.
Yeah, I mean, anything that I say would be purely anecdotal, other than we do have one site in Columbus, and we work pretty closely with them. And when they started to have problems, and we implemented it, you know, a program that would be what I do in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or New England. And within a couple of years, they're practically non-existent. I think the biggest problems that they're having there is, you know, kind of the education that, you know, everybody would roll their eyes about now. So it's, for me as an extension educator, it's almost difficult because I've got two sets. I've got, you know, people who are like, I don't need to know about the biology anymore. And then the people that really just need the ABCs of it. And I think that's right. Really what it is. I think we overthink these things.
I agree 100%. And we've been, I mean, this is just the course of doing business in the Northeast. And now it's a new issue for them to put in their rhythm down there. All right, listen, we're running.
And I'll say the last thing is it's a much more complex turf pest than any of the other turf pests where that have one generation per year. You have one timing. You've got a product that you can put down within 3 month window and you get them. That's why this just involves a little bit more being on the ball and selecting the right products.
And so I hate to bring up an unsolvable problem. I hate to bring it up, but I'm going to. But I saw this yesterday that annelids, which are worms, as a biomass on the planet, have more biomass than humans, livestock, and wild animals put together. So this is an indication that there's a lot of worms, a lot of biomass in the world on worms. All right. So let's start a little bit with some stuff that went away and now has come back. The irritant approach with the saponins. I saw a product at a golf course I visited just the other day called Castaway. Yep. Doesn't appear like we're trying to disguise this anymore. That we're controlling worms with early birds, so to speak. Thoughts on this as a primary strategy for addressing worm issues?
Yeah, so the saponins work. I mean, they definitely work. The problem is, you know, there's some variability between products. We've looked at Castaway. It looks just like Rhizoid. It looks just like early bird. They work. I mean, and it's obvious. It's a physical disruption. It irritates their mucousy skin. They come to the surface.
A lot of water.
Sequential applications, like you're not going to get anything that's in a cocoon. And so if you get marginal kill and you still have some adults out there, they're going to reproduce. I mean, they're very stable populations. So they produce a couple of cocoons every couple of weeks. So anything in the cocoon is just going to hatch out. And that's why you get like 21 days suppression with these. But if you do it every 21 days, three times in a row, we can flatline these things.
Right.
However, okay. I mean, that's like, I don't know anybody who can afford to do that. I mean, the cost of it is astronomical.
Yeah.
What I see with products, and this is crazy. I mean, I want to call half of the thing. No, not half. I'll say 95% of the products out there. If I see a product that says it doesn't kill them, it deters them. That's one that I see a lot. I'll say BS on that.
Okay.
If it says it doesn't kill them, it just stops them from casting. I would ask you, Frank, is there any organism that eats and doesn't shit on planet Earth?
I need to read my kids a book called Everyone Poops.
Yeah, exactly. We all have. But I mean, we're in a small community here where information is free flowing. I was explaining this to my wife. There's nothing like the turf industry. I just can't believe that there are companies out there, and we have the data that show that these things do not work, that they are familiar with, that they commission that work, and they still promote these kind of things out there. The only way you're going to kill an earthworm is if you physically disrupt it or if it gets into its nervous system, which is very similar to insect. That's why we deal with it in our laboratory. Those are the two mechanisms. We're looking at cultural practice. I know your colleague Kyle's doing some awesome stuff, too.
I want to go to Paige's work. Let's go to Paige's work at Arkansas because this made my head explode. Right? Because they did a beautiful video on Paige's work that you can find on YouTube when she was at Arkansas. And I know you've commented on this, and I want to just talk about the disparity between what I hear in the Pacific Northwest for large volumes of sand and what Paige has said and what you have said. And so first off, A soil root zone with light top dressing, lots of worms. Soil root zone, heavy top dressing, not many worms. Sand root zone, but none of these were statistically significant, said Page. Even though we got these differences, the variability, and this is one of the things Kyle laments to me all the time, is finding uniform populations. That's why you got to be on the road all the time to find populations you can study. So here's the question. Light top dressing may reduce casting activity in a soil root zone. Top dressing rate may not have any effect in a sand-based root zone. Can you provide any indication of where using sand or an abrasive material, you know, Williamson did blackjack many years ago, that fine glass stuff. What are your thoughts about deterring them through sand top dressing?
So one, I would say these are probably different worms than that we're dealing with. I would say the lack of statistical differences, I don't want to make too many inferences, but what I can say with our species, which is Aperodactyloidea longa, so it's like fairly common in the Northeast. It's a European species. I think we're going to submit that as a short publication for the International Turf. So if there's any reviewers out there that are looking to willing to look the other way on variability and understand that this is a lower tier journal, what we saw over a 3-year period with top dressing at fairway rates, you know, heavy and light, and then we really increased in the last year, is we saw more casting in heavy top dressing and light too. So even the light was heavier casting than that. And what I thought, it was like, you know, maybe it irritates them so they feed more, but that didn't make sense. And then we found a published article in Agriculture where they looked at sand content within the areas where earthworms were feeding, and it led to a greater digestibility of their food. So like a chicken with a crop, you know, they've got to grind down that organic material, and that allowed them to do that. So every time that we saw it, it was almost immediate. Like the ratings that we took right after that, and we applied these to the same plots year after year for a 3-year period, and it just kept going up and up and up in these plots. So relative to the untreated control. So different earthworms, very poorly understood group, which is surprising because they're a large, you know, organism. And, you know, most part, we look to agriculture and try to do the opposite because they want to promote them. So,
that's right.
You know, like what we've been looking at recently is like compacting, because we do see in agriculture in between rows of crops, they have less earthworms. And there's plenty of studies on that, that compaction might impact the cocoons and whatnot. We just can't compact them enough. And it's, you know, if you've got a lot of organic material in there and you're running a roller over these fairway plots, it's really that sponge effect. It's probably just temporary. It's probably, you probably can't compact them enough in turf until you start to lose turf because you've compacted it so greatly. So I think we're kind of looking at these things again. I think moisture is a big component to that. But as far as the cultural practices of top dressing, I think there's just so much organic material for them in the soil to feed upon. The other thing too is they feed on leaf material on the surface. So unless you're going to get rid of all that leaf material, I mean, there's a reason why this is somewhat unsolvable.
So, all right. So I know we are already way past, and I don't see any questions for us, Ben. I do have some things about ants, but I'm going to save them for another day. I will just say, it is a conundrum for me. When I go out to that Pacific Northwest and I see, and these superintendents swear by it, they'll say, Frank, I got 2 inches of sand over here. I don't have worms. Yeah. I got 1 inch over there and I got worms like crazy.
Yeah.
Is that a species difference, or is it you know, they got a lot of different climate than we got out there. I
mean, yes.
You know, that's Ireland sort of stuff.
So we, speaking of Ireland, we just did, last September, went over and we tried to survey these kind of where we see abrupt changes. This is what I always fascinated about, where you have casting that stops in a straight line. And so we selected sites that had this. We went to these sites. We did paired sampling, sent them to Micah in Brookside. We looked at every variable in there. We did it with the Pennsylvania samples as well. No two sites are different. And it wasn't sand. We had them on slopes where you would think like they'd roll down to the bottom. They were higher casting on slopes. We a lot of these courses in Ireland, really high pH, sand top, sand cap, like a 12-inch sand cap, and they're casted in that. So I think it's hard to generalize. I do think like the first thing that anybody needs to do when they do earthworm work is what species are you dealing with? And I think there's a lot of literature, like you just go way back and it's like, oh, earthworm, like I wouldn't just be able to say weevil, like a, you know, if it was an entomological study.
That's
So
right.
I think there are great differences. I think these things can tolerate a great deal. And I think soil pH is one that people always talk about. Oh, you got to acidify them. I think you'll see in the literature that these earthworms can handle a very wide range. And if you have a pH of 3, you're probably going to struggle to grow turf grass. You know,
That's exactly right.
so between 4 and 10, we're okay with most species.
Well, and I
So
gotta say, as we wrap it up, I mean, when I remember chatting with Jim Beard, the father of turf, many moons ago, and he had just finished some work looking at the maintenance practices at St. Andrews in the 17 and 1800s, pre-development of synthetic salt-based fertilizers like ammonium sulfate. And they had used so much, animal manure and leaf mold, and they'd created so much organic matter on the old course that actually there was talk that the game of golf would not continue because they couldn't get a playable surface because of the worms. And it wasn't until the caustic ammonium sulfate was developed that they could put out there and really irritate them. It literally saved the game of golf. So, lest we think worms aren't a big problem, it almost
I
wiped
know
out.
St. Andrews fairly well. I'm reading Gordon Moore's memoir right now, and he attributes it to putting out sand on the old course that they had earthworm problems when he started. So that would have been in the early 90s when he was working with Walter Woods. And I can tell you, every time I've been to St. Andrews, I find worm castings on the first fairway,
I
and it's
know.
hard as a friggin' rock there. You won't find a firmer surface, maybe
That's exactly.
Royal Melbourne, but man, it's they're everywhere. They're
They're
everywhere.
everywhere. All right, Ben. Thanks for
Awesome.
taking the time. Really
No
appreciate
problem.
you doing it. Hope our travels pass each other.
Yeah.
See you, brother.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.